Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY Community Public Radio. I'm Pamela Varcone, your host this evening. Tonight, we are very pleased to have on air with us two elected officials whose decisions and actions affect our lives every day, beginning with the Lieutenant Governor of Pennsylvania, Jim Cawley, followed by the representative from the 15th District of Pennsylvania, Congressman Charlie Dent. And joining me here in the studio midway through the program will be Muhlenberg Professor of Political Science, Chris Borick. This program is airing live, and our phone lines are open, so please call your questions and comments in to 610-758-8810. Before we begin, in the spirit of full disclosure, I would like to state that I serve as a member of the Pennsylvania Commission for Women. It is an appointed, volunteer position for which I receive no compensation. Our first guest is Jim Cawley, the 32nd Lieutenant Governor of the Commonwealth. And in that position, he presides over the Pennsylvania State Senate while spearheading many of the administration's most important initiatives, from Marcellus Shale to veterans issues. And we are so pleased to have Lieutenant Governor Cawley with us. Welcome.
Pam, it's a pleasure to be with you.
And speaking of important initiatives, I understand you have some news for us. This is very good timing.
Well, with the House is actually still debating at this point the transportation funding package. We had thought that the debate would have concluded, but I guess from a timing perspective, the members conspired so that it didn't quite work out, but we expect that very shortly the transportation funding package will move to a final vote in the House of Representatives.
Lieutenant Governor Cawley, why don't you bring our audience up to speed on what you think the benefits of this are? Because I can tell you the front page of the Morning Call this morning reflected a lot of concern about what this is going to cost the people of the Commonwealth.
Well, I will tell you directly some of the projects that are going to be funded in the in Lehigh County and in Northampton County that I know would be of interest to your listeners. $44 million to widen Route 22 in Lehigh County, $27 million for improvements to 78, $49 million for improvements to 309 in Northampton, $3 million for Route 248 resurfacing, $6.4 million for improvements to Route 611, and $8 million more for the Lehigh and Northampton Transit Authority. This is a significant investment in our roads, in our bridges, in our infrastructure, in our public transit, and it is allowing our Pennsylvania to continue to move forward. There is, in fact, a direct correlation between good roads and bridges and job growth and economic opportunity. I can't tell you, first as a county commissioner in Bucks County and now as lieutenant governor, I cannot tell you how many companies and corporations I meet with that consider Pennsylvania to site their business. And one of the very top of the list important issues for them is, do they have good access? Do they have good roads and bridges? Can they move their men, their material, their goods, their services in a significant way so that they can be more efficient? This will continue the efforts of our administration. You know, partnering with the private sector since this administration started, we've been able to create 140,000 new family-sustaining jobs in this state. That's a good start. We want to keep going, and this investment in transportation is going to provide us the opportunity to continue to be a competitor among states for job opportunities and, indeed, a competitor among nations for job opportunities.
Well, there's certainly no doubt what I-78 did for the Lehigh Valley when that opened up.
Absolutely, and you can tell the stories of how roads that are more passable, that are in better condition, stormwater management systems that take water off those roads so that they can be passable in storms and in natural events are so very important in order to continue to attract businesses. But I would say this to you, Pam, even if there are folks out there who are skeptical of this being really a jobs bill as much as it is a transportation bill. Consider this. Every day, in every school day in this Commonwealth, 1.5 million of our children get on a bus and go back and forth to school every day. As a parent, as a Pennsylvanian, I think we have a duty to make sure that the roads and bridges that they're on are safe. So if for no other reason, this is also a public safety bill as well. We've got to make sure that the roads and bridges are safe and are passable.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the cost, because I think we do have to look at that side of us. Can you explain to our audience how this is going to be paid for?
Sure. Primarily the way in which it's going to be paid for is right now in this state, there is a tax that oil and gas companies pay called the wholesale franchise tax. Now, this is the tax that's paid when an oil company sells a wholesale gallon of gasoline to a retailer who then in turn sells it to all of us, the consumer. In the mid-1980s, for whatever reason, the legislature put a cap on the amount of the value of a gallon of wholesale gasoline. They capped it at $1.25, even though the value around the mid-90s far exceeded $1.25, but yet they're only paying tax on the $1.25 value. It would be like this, Pam. It would be as if you or I went into a convenience store and we pulled a 16-ounce bottle of Coke from the shelf and went to the cashier to pay for that Coca-Cola. We're going to pay tax on all 16 ounces of that Coke. The gas companies are only paying tax on 10 ounces, even though they're getting 16. This is a matter of equity. This is a matter of fairness. This is a matter of the gasoline companies and the oil companies paying what you and I already pay. Now, I know that there are those who are concerned about what we as consumers, what we as the users of the roads are going to pay. I've got some good news there, actually. What this measure also does is that liquid fuels tax, which is that tax that all of us pay at the pump, is going to be, 12 cents of that is going to be repealed. We're actually going to reduce the amount that the average consumer pays in that liquid fuels tax. So we don't know necessarily, once that cap is removed and the oil companies are paying what they arguably should have been paying all along, how much of that will be transferred over to the consumer. But we do know the tax that we control here in the state is going to be reduced by 12 cents a gallon. So that's, I think, good news for the consumers.
And is that going to be the only source of revenue for this new bill?
That is the primary source of revenue, but there is going to be increases in registration fees, in other user fees, but the primary way in which this infrastructure investment is going to be funded is through the method that I just explained.
And when do you expect this to start to take effect?
Well,
once you get it passed, of course.
As I'm watching now the debate on PCN on the House floor, we first obviously have to wait for the House to actually pass the bill. We don't want to presume anything. But the effective date is in some cases almost immediately. The phase-in of the removal of that cap on the wholesale franchise tax is going to be over the course of 5 years. There'll be a partial phase in year one, and then in year three, and then in year five. So it will be a gradual phase in over time.
So you expect this to not have a heavy impact on the consumer?
Well, I can't, with a straight face, and in all honesty, tell you that it's not going to have an impact. But what the impact will be versus the steps that we've taken to make sure that whatever effect that we can do to help to lessen the burden on the consumer, we are taking at this point.
I do want to let our audience know that there is a very innovative and very easy to navigate map that is available that shows the projects that will benefit from this transportation bill should it be passed. And we will be posting that on the WDIY website when the podcast is put up, which we believe will be on Monday. So when you come to the when the listening public comes to the WDIY website, you will be able to find that map, and you will be able to click on your county, and you'll be able to see both the short-term and the long-term projects that will be impacting in your area, the bridges and the roads that will benefit from this transportation bill should it pass. Lieutenant Governor, I think it would be safe to say that this has been a very interesting coalition that has come together, both supporting this bill and opposing it. What kind of a political square dance have you and the governor had to do?
Well, I will tell you that it has been a very interesting process to this point. The governor announced earlier this year that his legislative priorities, that he would have three main legislative priorities. This, of course, transportation funding being one of them, the others being the reform of our pension system and the privatization of our wine and spirit system in this state. And the work continues on the latter two, but all through this entire year, Governor Corbett has continued to demonstrate integrity and leadership in just seeing these issues through to completion. I mean, as late as this week, it has been a bit of a roller coaster. On Monday night, the House of Representatives actually voted down the proposal. Then on Tuesday, some 24 hours later, they approved virtually the same funding package.
That must have been some interesting backroom arm twisting to get between Monday and Tuesday.
It was actually when the vote initially was cast in the House of Representatives, the vote was 101 in favor to 100 opposed. And the Speaker was hopeful, I think, of getting to 102, and there was even some there were some things that were going on the floor of the House while the measure was being considered. There was obviously some continuing discussions thereafter, and all through the following day, and ultimately the measure did pass the House on Tuesday and passed the Senate last evening, and now we're hopeful that it's going to finally pass here in the House tonight.
Well, Lieutenant Governor Cawley, while you and I were talking, Professor Chris Borick has joined us. He winged his way in from Harrisburg from taping a television show, and I'm sure that he would certainly like to talk to you, too.
Great.
Hey, good evening, Lieutenant Governor.
Good evening, Chris. How are you?
Good. I was stuck in traffic. That's why I'm late. It's obviously it's been a very big week, and this is such a big priority for the Corbett administration, as you noted. You mentioned those other two major agenda items that are on the governor's legislative agenda for this year. In terms of thinking about the order that they're going to be in and how you're going to go about trying to put together similar coalitions, what do you think the horizon looks like?
Well, I would say, Chris, that as well, you know, a legislative session lasts for 2 years, and the governor has been loath to put any artificial deadlines on when any of these issues would be taken up and ultimately accomplished. And he's also been quick to point out that all three of the agenda items were priorities to him, and he did not rank them. They were all number one, if you will, number one, number one, number one. For me to forecast right now what will be the next issue that will ripen and be able to be accomplished, I don't think I'm in a position to do as of yet. I think what you will see, however, is a continued commitment by the governor to continue to move his legislative agenda forward.
No, that of course is fair. The one thing I'd ask in terms of both those pieces of legislation, what would you say from your perspective are the major hindrances to move forward, particularly on pension reform in the state?
Well, pension reform, of course, is a challenge because in reforming our system, there are so many current employees who are part of the system, as you well know, and perhaps the listeners know as well. The public school teachers are considered to be state employees when it comes to the issue of the pension system. So there are a great many people out there who, frankly, grow concerned or nervous when discussion is made about changing any of their benefit package. I think that's why we've seen a migration on this issue toward a discussion of moving new hires away from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan, and there's less of an appetite, if you will, to have the discussion on changing or reforming the way in which the benefits are given to current employees. I think that's really been the discussion point that has kind of held everyone's attention so far.
Well, Lieutenant Governor Cawley, we know that you need to leave for another engagement, and we want to thank you very much for being with us this evening and giving this update to us. And I
appreciate it greatly.
We wish you well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We want to thank our listeners for being with us. There's much more to come. So please stay right here on WDIY Lehigh Valley Community Public Radio. I'm Pamela Varcone, and we'll be right back.
WDIY is pleased to partner with the Greater Lehigh Valley Chamber of Commerce presenting A Lehigh Valley Christmas on Sunday, December 1st from 7 to 10 p.m. at Miller Symphony Hall. Performances by Zen for Primates, Dave Fry, Jay Kaligas, the BC Combo, Lucky Seven, the James Supra Blues Band, and many other Lehigh Valley favorites.
For more information, 610-751-4929 or online at allentownsymphony.org/lvxmas.aspx.
For program support on WDIY, we thank the Sands Bethlehem Events Center, presenting an evening with Kenny G in his 2013 holiday show. Saxophonist Kenny G will be performing holiday favorites Thursday, December 19th, 8 p.m. Tickets for this holiday performance are on sale now. Tickets and information on this and other shows at sandseventcenter.com.
And now I would like to officially introduce our guest who has joined us in the studio, having just driven in from Harrisburg, and that is Muhlenberg Professor and Director of the College's Institute for Public Opinion, Christopher Borick. Chris, thank you very much.
Oh, thanks, Pamela. Thanks for having me on tonight.
And I would say from the interview with Lieutenant Governor Cawley, it sounds like the transportation bill is still being battled out on the floor.
It's absolutely the case. There's been a lot of maneuvering going on this week that the Lieutenant Governor alluded to when he was answering your question, Pamela, and some interesting alignment of parties, if you will. This is, if you're any follower of politics in Harrisburg or Washington, for that matter, we haven't seen a lot of votes like this in a considerable amount of time where really party lines are blurred. You have about an equal amount of the Democratic caucus breaking for this bill and a similar percentage in the Republican caucus. So it really has blended some strange coalitions, if you will, into getting this bill where it seems it's on the verge, at least, of finally getting approval.
And when you break down along those party lines, Chris, between the Democrats that are supporting it and the Republicans that are supporting it, that coalition in support and the coalition against, how would you define them? It appears to me that the Republican Coalition for is more of kind of the traditional, what we might call establishment Republicans, and the Republicans who are opposed are perhaps more what we might describe as, although I don't like these kinds of labels, more the Tea Party no taxes, no increase in at any cost.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair appraisal, Pamela. When you look at I went to the voting list last night, if you will, the roll call for some of the earlier votes on this. That's exactly what you saw. More traditional pro-business conservative Republicans in the state house tended to break in the direction of this piece of legislation, and some of the more recent, more, as you would say, Tea Party aligned members of the caucus, who are very adversarial to any type of policy that would be considered a tax raise. And I think you're going to, no matter how we play with the semantics of this, that we're asking for revenue increases mm-hmm. that largely are going to be paid by people driving in the state. Mm-hmm. And we could make the case if that's a net benefit or cost. But for those individuals who have taken those stance that they're just simply not going to support those types of policies, they broke against. And on the Democratic side, you saw some interesting politics going on, too, with support for labor unions. And the labor unions...
Well, it's going to be a job generator.
Absolutely. But there was also one of the sticking points in the legislation was prevailing wage components on that had some of the labor unions waffling on this. But in the end, I think you saw some coalition and some support from labor unions to say, you know, this is a good enough deal. And it's interesting. You don't hear that a lot in politics these days where people would say, well, it's not perfect, but it's a deal that we can accept. And in this particular case, at least on the verge, according to the lieutenant governor and all the other reports out of Harrisburg, they're close to putting together a fairly unique coalition.
The ghost of Ronald Reagan. If you're my friend and you vote with me 80% of the time, you're my friend.
Very much so.
I'm not going to hold that 20% against you.
It's if you're building big coalitions for either party, I think it's a good strategy. And you know, I know we're in an era of some ideological lines being drawn and difficult in doing that. But for an important issue like this, and I think Lieutenant Governor did a good job of laying it out, there are many benefits. Yeah, the people are going to pay. There's no doubt about it. You shouldn't lie, and I'm glad he didn't say anything that he was trying to hide. It. Some of those costs are put off. Politically, we'll be good. We're not going to see those in 2014. We're going to see them in 2015 and 2016 down the road. So it's after the election. So there's some positives there for the Corbett re-election bid. But in the essence, is it a net benefit, you know, for business, for transportation, for efficiency, for driving, you know, across the valley? I was listening to the beginning of the show while I was stuck on Route 22, you know, and that's – I don't know if this is all going to be solved with this, and it's the answer.
Well,
but clearly it is.
He said widening 22 is part of the agenda.
It's part of it for sure.
Well, I think that there is no doubt that increased infrastructure, which this country needs desperately, not just in Pennsylvania. You don't want to get me started on, you know, high-speed transit and all of the things that I think we should be doing. But the problem is we've all got those wish lists, and then we all have to figure out how to pay for them. And it's a very, very tricky territory when you go out to do that.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime you're asking about where the bucks are going to come from, right, where are we going to get the revenue for this? And I think the realization for years was we're going to have to do it from a number of points, like our registration fees, like our licenses, someplace at the pump. We're going to have to pay for that, and that's a burden, and it doesn't fall equally, right? Some people drive.
It absolutely does not, because you've got people who are just barely making it, who do go to work every day, and it is going to hit them. It is not anything like a VAT or a luxury tax. It's going to hit everybody,
yeah.
And the person who's making $150,000 a year, it's not going to hit them proportionately.
Yeah, they simply won't notice it as much, right? When you're very limited in terms of your day-to-day expenses and that gas fee goes up by, you know, 10 cents, 20 cents, 30 cents, you feel it. And that's why gas taxes have always been one of the most difficult taxes to pass. I mean, I think we're alluding to a bit of the regressive nature of it, but also we see that tax, right? Or at least we, you know, we might not see it, but we notice the price of gas. And if that on that week people see it going up, there's usually a price to pay politically. In this case, I won't be for till after the 2014 election.
Well, we can only hope that compensating for that on the other side is the fact that the United States is becoming more self-sufficient in oil production, and that hopefully will stabilize at least the base price.
Oh yeah, I mean it's a whole conversation we could have about the energy markets right now and the energy fields. It's an absolutely dynamic period from natural gas entering into the scene. The conversation we're having about energy as a whole, if you told me, Pamela, 5 years ago, as someone that studies energy and environmental policy, that this is where we would be, I would have laughed.
Mm-hmm.
But it really has changed everything.
Everything.
And the idea
mm-hmm.
that we could the concept of energy independence, I always thought was a dream. I don't know if it's in full form something that we could say is reachable, but to a large degree, it's on the table in a way that it never has been before.
Yes, shale oil has done wonderful things for us in many ways. We just hope that we can all stay safe and keep our drinking water yep. safe. And the one thing that I didn't get to talk to the lieutenant governor about that I would have really liked to is how Pennsylvania is handling the rollout of the Affordable Health Care Act. And of course, we're one of the states that yep. did not sign on. And Chris, do you have any insight on that, about how the state is handling that?
Yeah, you know, as you said, Pamela, the decision by the Corbett administration was to opt out of the Medicaid expansion, and that the governor earlier this year came up with an alternative proposal where for those individuals that are that could have received the expansion, if indeed the state had opted into the federal offer, that they would instead allow individuals to use some of the resources, the public funding, to go out on the marketplace and purchase their insurance. So that was the Corbett plan, if you will, on the twist. A number of other states have tried similar plans, and actually there's some lawsuits out there to test the legality of that going on. So it's not settled business by any means. But Pennsylvania is in that situation where it's gone its own way. Some would say, given the difficulties in the early stages of the Affordable Care Act's mm-hmm. rollout, that mm-hmm. that might not be necessarily a bad thing. And so there's lots of debate. It's such a fluid situation right now. I mean, we really are. I think anybody I've talked with given a lot of talks this fall in on the healthcare issue, and anybody that says they have a solid feel of exactly where things at is probably delusional. It's simply mm-hmm. the parts are moving so quickly, and trying to get a sense of actually how this is all going to play out. We talk about uncertainty, right? For insurers, for people buying insurance, for states, for the federal government, there's really a lack of certainty. And that's always difficult for policymaking. It's difficult for citizens. And
very difficult for business.
Oh, absolutely. Businesses are on the fence, right? They, you know, if you talk to anybody in the business world, the mm-hmm. thing they love is some certainty. They could react to it, right? Mm-hmm. When you lack that in terms of making your decisions on healthcare provision, is very difficult.
And well, so, the trillions of dollars that big business in America is holding back on or is holding overseas, I think definitely the Health Care Act plays into it, because they're just not going to start spending this money or bring it back into the country until they know exactly what is going to happen with health care and, quite frankly, what's going to happen with tax reform in general.
Oh, I think both of those things. They're looking for a little bit of direction and certainty, and that's the next big, you know, maybe this is a nice lead-in when Congressman Dent comes on to talk about
that. That's my plan.
I think it's a great plan. Where are we going? Not only on, I'm sure he'll have some interesting insight on the Affordable Care Act, but also on the bigger deals, the bigger budget deals that at least are in the talking stage in Washington right now. The Murray-Ryan coalition, if you will, that's trying to piece together a package.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading a lot over the last few weeks, and some optimism, which is a rare word in Washington, about perhaps at least inklings of movement between Murray and Ryan to iron out a package that might have a possibility of clearing enough support, similar to what we saw with the transportation bill in Pennsylvania.
If Pennsylvania can do it, maybe Washington.
We need
can
some
do
strange
it.
Coalitions right now, is what we need.
I don't know. I don't have as much faith in Washington as I do in Pennsylvania. I think it's a little bit easier to manage when you're right there with your home folks all the time. I think when you're in Washington, you're just isolated enough that it's a little bit more difficult to do. We are talking to Chris Borick, professor at Muhlenberg College and director of their Public Policy Institute. And we are going to take a very short break and come back with Congressman Charlie Dent. Thank you all very much for listening. This is WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio.
Spread the word about your organization or business to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced music programs reaches thousands of locally engaged listeners each day. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable way to enhance your image and to provide information about your services to people who care. For more information, visit wdiy.org.
For program support on WDIY, we thank Touchstone Theater, presenting Christmas City Follies Thursday, December 5th through the 22nd at Touchstone Theater. A Bethlehem holiday tradition, this Touchstone Theater ensemble created classic yet again reimagines what the holidays are all about with music, wit, and holiday hijinks. For information, 610-867-1689 or touchstone.org.
Welcome back to WDIY, Lehigh Valley Community Public Radio. I'm Pamela Varcone, your host this evening. And joining me here in the studio is Professor Chris Borick of Muhlenberg College. Chris and I are about to welcome Congressman Charlie Dent to the program. Before we do, I want to remind our audience that we are taking calls this evening at 610-758-8810. We look forward to hearing from you. Again, that's 610-758-8810. Charlie Dent is currently serving his fifth term, having been first elected to represent the 15th District of Pennsylvania in 2004. Charlie serves on the House Appropriations and Ethics Committees. He previously served on the House Homeland Security and Transportation Committees. He has been an active member of Congress introducing legislation on a range of issues, from health care to criminalizing the use of synthetic drugs. Congressman Dent is also a member of that Tuesday group of moderate Republicans, a position which brought him to national prominence during the recent government shutdown. Welcome, Congressman Charlie Dent.
Hi, Pam, and hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on the program.
Hi, Congressman. How are you tonight?
I'm doing just great.
Well, Professor Borick and I have come to an easy consensus that the first topic to be addressed has to be, what do you see as the future of the Affordable Health Care Act, also known as Obamacare?
Oh, boy. I mean, I don't think anybody knows at this point. Clearly, this rollout has gone far worse than anybody would have ever expected, you know, with the website being so problematic and the fact that it appears that the exchange enrollment is very low, and certainly among young people. And so I don't know that anybody knows what the future of this law is going to be, because it appears right now we are moving into what the insurance industry describes as adverse selection, where you have, you know, an older, sicker pool in the exchange and fewer younger, healthier people, and it breaks apart the financial model of the law. And in fact, the decision by the administration to allow states to continue allowing people to stay in their plans, while we certainly applaud that, that will further undermine the exchanges. And so, you know, it's one hell of a mess, is what I guess what I'm saying to you. And I don't know that there's a quick answer. I think the least we should do is try to at least delay the implementation of this law for a period of time.
Yeah, it would appear from a layman's point of view, and that's certainly what my point of view is that this little patch that they're trying to put on it is actually could make things worse, that they would almost be better to put a stop on it and just not enforce it right now until they can get it straightened out.
Well, yeah, I mean, but what we're seeing happening, what little information or data we have about people enrolling in the program is we're finding more and more people are enrolling in Medicaid. Well, that does not help these exchanges. And in order for these exchanges to be successful, the administration needs to drive people out of the individual insurance market, which is maybe somewhere close to, I guess, 8% of Americans, or maybe 5 to 8% of Americans, and they are going to need to go into the exchanges. Now, I don't particularly like that, but that's what they need to make this thing work. I think at this point we're going to have to probably seriously consider a delay. The only thing I can say is at least the employer mandate was delayed for a year. And had the employer mandate been implemented at come the new year, I believe that would you multiply this program by three or four or five fold, and you would that's what you'd be dealing with right now, because when that employer mandate hits, there are going to be enormous disruptions in people's coverages, because many employers are going to figure out that it's cheaper to pay a $2,000 fine or penalty than to provide insurance if they employ more than 50 people. And so that's the other issue that I've been watching very carefully, but that's a year off, but people are already making plans, you know, along the line that it will be implemented.
Congressman Dent, you've obviously in this fall been active in seeking out bipartisan agreement on some of the key issues that have been facing the Congress and the nation. Do you have any sense right now? Is there movement within the Democratic caucus and individuals that you've worked with in the past to try and broker some type of either short-term or long-term actions on the Affordable Care Act that you might see in the making?
Well, you know, I've talked to one of my colleagues, John Barrow, a Democrat from Georgia. He made some comments yesterday, and I briefly chatted with him today. He's talking about a further delay of the individual mandate. And I think that's important because there are several Democrats who are, you know, as he would say, you know, we just can't talk about the people who are being helped by the law. We have to talk about the people who are being hurt by the law. And it's at this point, you know, he suggested, and I agree with him, that we're going to have to delay this individual mandate as well as the employer mandate. I think that's where the bipartisan consensus, I think, is emerging on that individual mandate, which is driving, of course, much of the disruption right now in the individual market. So I think that's where we will likely go on the healthcare law. If there's going to be anything we might agree to in terms of a major change of the healthcare law, that might be it.
Well, might we see that before the end of the year?
Don't know yet. You know, I think part of this is, the Democratic leadership has not yet arrived at that position. As time drags on, I think they'll be forced to, because enough of their members are probably going to speak up on this. That's my sense. I mean, you see what's happening in the Senate with, I guess, Mary Landrieu and others. You know, they're actually proposing a more extreme proposal, saying the insurance companies must allow people to stay in their policies. And now that might be desirable. It's really not a practical solution. And so I think there are a number of members who are recognizing now that delaying the individual mandate is probably the best thing we can do at this point. And there may be other... there may be other issues. I mean, again, I we're in uncharted territory. You know, you hear about this whole notion of an insurance death spiral. I'm afraid that we might be in it right now, and that's because of what's happening out in that healthcare marketplace. So, but that bipartisan consensus, I think, is going to be on the individual mandate.
So by that death spiral, Congressman Dent, are you talking about the end of private insurance companies as we know them?
No, I'm talking about the fact that you're going to have all these companies that are going to be providing insurance in the exchanges, they're going to have an older and sicker pool. And what that means is, since they have fewer young people signing up, that the rates will necessarily be increased for a lot of folks who are older and sicker. And it's just not a viable business model. The issue, and I think that's the death spiral that we're talking about, which speaks to what they call adverse selection. And I'm not sure that there's a plan to deal with it.
Well, and the rates at where we're at this moment in the plan are already increasing in many cases. I mean, yeah. I know how many horror stories I've heard. I can imagine how many horror stories you've heard.
Well, I can tell you, a guy, a farmer from Berks County, was telling me he got pushed out. You know, the problem is that they're paying a lot more. He can't afford to pay more. I've talked to other folks who've been in the individual market. They bought plans that they were quite comfortable with. And the problem is some of them can't. It's not just that they're going to pay higher rates. Some of them are not going to be able to continue to see their current providers or their doctors.
Mm-hmm.
That's the other problem. Some of them are being pushed out of their plans, but it also means they're not only losing their coverage, but they're going in, but they can't find a plan that will allow them to keep their current provider. That's the other issue too that we're hearing. And frankly, since people can't access the website, many of them are going bare. So they have their policy canceled. And then they can't get on the website, they can't get into the exchanges. So at the moment, some of them are fearful that they may not have insurance going into the new year. Maybe the website issue will be resolved by then, but at the moment, it's a big problem.
Congressman Dent, I'm sure you're more than familiar with the difficulties that the Affordable Care Act has had, and we had a nice discussion on this. The long-term negatives, if you will, in terms of public attitudes about this issue in terms of the Republican Party are alternatives. And the idea of, yes, if we were to replace it or amend it or repeal and all the options, where do we go at this point? And I know it's hard since we're in the midst of this right now, and this is the reality, to think about what type of direction or options might be looked at by the Republican Party. But in general, what kind of direction would you advocate, or do you think your party's advocating if you had the chance to steer the ship at this point?
I do about five or six things, actually. One, we deal with a cost driver. We would deal with a medical liability situation, because it is a cost driver, not just for the doctors and the hospitals paying the liability premiums, but because it encourages a lot of procedures and tests and services that are rendered that are unnecessary out of fear of lawsuit, which is a cost driver. So we deal with the comprehensive medical liability reform, one. Two, we should also deal with allowing people to do cross-state purchases of insurance. Three, allow small businesses to pool together and realize greater discounts to associated health plans, kind of like big companies do right now that self-insure. They get out from under the state rules, give small businesses the same opportunity to get those types of discounts that the larger that the larger employers receive. That's the third thing. Another thing we're going to have to deal with is, of course, the tax code. And we're going to have to look at equalizing tax treatment. Right now, the tax code, I think, is a big part of our – is partly what drives the utilization of health services, where we have employers who are given very generous tax exclusion. It's an employer tax exclusion, which is good. It helps employers provide health benefits. But if an employee, if a working person, does not have employer-sponsored coverage, you know, he or she has to use after-tax dollars to purchase insurance, and at a considerably higher cost. So maybe we should figure out a way to equalize tax treatment, so that individuals can purchase this thing in a more effective manner than is currently the case. Those are about three or four things I think we could do immediately. Also, with respect to those who have pre-existing conditions or illnesses, I mean, I think everybody agrees that if you're in that condition, that you should have access to affordable health insurance, and many of those people will need to be subsidized. This is where I think that the Republicans and the Democrats actually have some level of agreement, although we disagree with how to go about it, but we agree in concept that that we should have high-risk pools administered at the state level and make sure that they are properly funded and subsidized, so that it's a place where people can go to buy insurance. You can do this through a reinsurance model or the high-risk pool model, and I think that's a great way for us to help those with the pre-existing conditions and illnesses, because that's a big part of our problem. There are people out there who just can't buy insurance because of their health conditions. So those are about five or six things I think we could do now. Help the people who need to be helped. I mean, let's remember, about 85% of us do have coverage, and many Americans are happy with their coverage. They're not happy with what they're paying for it, but they are generally satisfied. But you know, we have 10 to 15% of the population that needs help. Let's focus on the 10 to 15%. What's happening is, to help the 10 to 15%, there are going to be significant disruptions to the 85%, and that's what's making much of the American public very uneasy and happy and downright angry in some cases.
Congressman Dent, we're sitting here in the studio, and somebody just slipped a note to us that said, someone that works here, and they said that they were able to sign up quite easily 2 weeks ago. They got through on the website, they got very good coverage, and they're paying less than they did before, and they're very happy, and they wanted us to know that.
That's good to hear. I'm glad to hear that. Unfortunately, most of the calls I'm getting in my office, fortunately or unfortunately, are people who are unhappy that they are not able to get a better price.
Well, I have to admit, Congressman, in my position as a writer and commentator and everything, a lot of people, talk to me and tell me their stories. And I have to say, I think this is the first positive story that I have heard, although I'm very glad to hear it.
And some people will get subsidized, by the way. There are some people who are going into the exchanges, and they're going to pay more because they can't get a subsidy. Some people who will be subsidized, it's true, they will pay less.
Well, I do think, and I want to move on to other topics because we're halfway through our time with you, and there's so many other things we want to talk to you about. But I do have to say that I think it's important for us to realize that there is no income verification on this, and that to me is just a recipe for disaster.
Well, actually, we did as part of the continuing resolution debt ceiling agreement that was enacted on October the 16th, I guess. The only thing that we really put in there was that we did require that income verification be enforced. The administration a few months back had basically said they were going to ignore or delay the income verification requirement in the law, which was troubling to many of us. And so we actually did reinstate the enforcement as part of that continuing resolution debt ceiling agreement. Because you're right, a lot, you know, we just can't have people signing up and just take their word for it that their income is what they say it is. We have to have an enforcement mechanism, a verification mechanism, because the program would be rife with fraud otherwise.
Well, let's take you over to a couple of other subjects that I know Professor Boric and I are interested in, and I presume our audience is too. We are very interested in talking about immigration, because once we get past the Affordable Health Care Act, however that all shakes out, it seems that immigration is certainly going to be the next thing on the agenda, and is certainly going to be a big issue in 2014 and 2016. Can you enlighten us, Congressman, on where you're coming down on the immigration issue?
Sure. On immigration, a few things. First, I think we all agree that the immigration system is broken. The legal system needs to be repaired, and there are a few things we must do. First, we have to make sure that we have a plan for operational control of the border or border security, that we have interior enforcement, that we have employer verification through mandatory e-verify, that we know that people are who they say they are. We need to deal with that. We need to manage exit better. I think the Senate bill on this particular point, I think, has done a pretty good job of trying to establish a biometric for exit. You know, our problem is, you know, somewhere between one-third to one-half of the people in this country illegally entered legally. And the issue is people don't leave when they're supposed to. So we have to develop a better system of exit. And so that's an issue that must be confronted. We have to deal with areas of labor shortage, or particularly skill shortages at all levels, from agricultural workers to the STEM field, science, technology, engineering, math. I mean, I've been supportive of, you know, of people who are getting terminal degrees or advanced degrees in science, engineering, math, that, you know, that they're coming out of a place like Lehigh with a degree in chemical engineering. You know, maybe we ought to stample a green card application to their diploma.
Well, I think that I do want to insert what I think is an important point to make here, that when we are talking about immigration and we're talking about who's legal and illegal, we are not just talking about a Hispanic population. There are many, many people who are here illegally or who have overstayed their green card or their student visa from other countries beside Latin American countries.
Well, sure. I mean, in fairness, the largest... I've seen some numbers of this. I'm just going to try to recall them. But the largest number of people who are in this country unlawfully are from Mexico, by a pretty significant margin. And then, but you're right. I mean, it would be unfair to suggest that this is simply a Mexican or Latin American problem. It is not. You know, we have, you know, in fact, I don't want to bore you with all the details, but last time I checked, we had 150,000 people in this country awaiting removal who have valid removal orders against them, they've been through due process. And we can't deport them, back to their home countries. They come from eight countries, and they're China, India, Laos, Vietnam, Iran, Somalia, Jamaica, and I'm forgetting one or two. But those countries, they won't repatriate their own citizens. And the Supreme Court has said we cannot hold people indefinitely, and so we have to let them out at some point. I mean, so we have all sorts of issues in terms of deportation. One other thing I want to mention, too, we do have to deal responsibly with these children, especially who are here no fault of their own, who came here at a very young age, brought here by their parents. This is the only place or country they've ever known. And I believe you're going to see a consensus that we will find a way to deal responsibly with these children here no fault of their own. So I think that's something that can happen, I think during this term of Congress. At the very least, the kids' bill. And I think nobody is advocating, you know, I think a reckless approach to the 11 million people here unlawfully. That I think if we do this right, you know, if we fix the legal system, if we make sure the caps in the visa programs are high, and we should remember that if the legal system is not repaired, we will get more illegal immigration. I mean, that's something I think we can never lose sight of. So if we have unrealistically low caps on the number of people we let into this country legally, they will find their way here illegally, or they'll overstay. And so that's why it's imperative that we fix the legal system, because you cannot correct the illegal immigration problem without fixing the legal system. And so the two issues are very much connected and related. Now, with respect to the 11 million people, as I said, we'll deal with the kids, I think, more quickly. But for the adults, many at some point, provided we do all these other things from border security going forward, then there would probably be many of them would be placed into a legal status. There would be all sorts of fines, penalties, back taxes, end of the line. And then what we would do, in all likelihood, is create a larger barrier for them to reach citizenship. Some could reach it, but not all would. But there would be a path for those. That would probably be a bit more rigorous than for somebody who's trying to come in, you know, lawfully and legally. And so that's something that is also being developed as part of the solution. Because, I mean, there are 11 million people plus in this country who are here unlawfully. I don't know how you could deport all of them, honestly. I mean, think our population in Pennsylvania is, pushing almost 13 million. I mean, think of deporting the entire population of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. There really is not a practical or a smart logistical way to do that, or a humane way, for that matter. So we have to deal with that issue realistically. But above all else, we do not want to be in a situation in 10 or 20 years from now where we have, you know, another 15 million people here unlawfully. That would be a disaster.
Well, a plan that holds out hope, no matter how difficult the road may be, that holds out hope to those 11 million that they could stay and become legal, probably is, as you said, the humane way to look at that.
Well, we have, I mean, again, and there's a way, I want to say something, too, about the process on this thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Senate passed one big comprehensive bill. I'm not crazy about that approach. I think this immigration issue needs to be broken into about five or six pieces: border security, E-Verify, agriculture workers, STEM workers, the children, and I could probably think of one or two other areas. But deal with this in digestible bits, because I think most of the American public will agree with most of what we're trying to do here. That's not to say they're going to agree with everything we're doing, but at least present it to them in a way that they can understand it. They understand the need to get people working in agriculture, because if we don't, we're going to have to import more food, or food will be dying on the vines and in the fields. And they understand that. And I think we also understand, too, that, let's face it, a lot of folks in this country would rather not work in production agriculture, and we are very reliant on imported labor to meet our food needs. And I think we have to be very, very honest about that.
Congressman, I'm going to pick up on Pamela's theme of hope. And you were at the center of the storm in the dark days of the government shutdown and the debt ceiling crisis back in October. As you more than anybody are aware, we've postponed some of that debate and pushed it down the road. And here's where I'm interested in if you'll support this optimism or hope. I've heard good things. I've read good things about your colleague Paul Ryan and Senator Patty Murray of Washington and their work on trying to craft some longer term deals or even moderate term deals on both debt and on the government budget issues and fiscal issues. Could you report anything out of the work that's happening there, or and maybe even give us a little hope?
Sure. I spoke to Paul Ryan on Tuesday morning about it. About this whole issue, and I said, Paul, look, I'm not about raising expectations. I said, Paul, all I'm asking is that we need you and Senator Murray to come to an agreement on the top line funding number for this year and next. We call it the 302A number. It's appropriation speak. I'm on the committee, but it's the 302A number. It's a top line number, and we need the House and the Senate to work off the same number. And he stopped me. He said, Charlie, I know you guys in the Appropriations Committee don't think we want to do that, but I think we can get there. So that gave me some hope. Because why that's important is because if the House and Senate come to an agreement, the budgeteers or the conferees, if they come to an agreement on that top funding level line, whatever it is, then the Appropriations Committee will be able to pass. Then the Appropriations Committee will be able to pass the appropriations bills, and we won't have to do these continuing resolutions. Now, if the budgeteers fail, then we'll have to move to another continuing resolution. Now, Paul Ryan also seems to think we might be able to get to a, you know, maybe a small down payment on some type of a fiscal reform. I hope he's right, and I'm going to be optimistic, too. I'm encouraging these guys to come to an agreement. I just need them to do it fast.
Congressman, we have a question that has been called in from a gentleman named John in Easton, and he would like to know about the Problem Solvers Group. What is it, and will the group address carbon pollution?
The issue is the Problem Solvers Group, a group called No Labels Problem Solvers. We have about 80 members, Republican and Democrat, and we sit down regularly just to talk about issues we want to advance. We put forward a 9-bill package. I've introduced one with Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, to essentially start requiring the administration to look seriously at these Government Accountability Office recommendations in terms of streamlining outdated programs and consolidations. And they've identified over 300 areas, and we're going to force the administration to try to act on them. If they don't, then they have to come to Congress and explain why, and we can vote on them. So that's one idea. There are other bills. There's an energy efficiency bill. There's not any specific plan on carbon production or mitigation, but there is an energy efficiency bill that Peter Welsh, the Democrat, and I forgot who the Republican is. I think it's Reed Ribble of Wisconsin, are the two who are pushing this Energy Efficiency Act, which, you know, again, that's, you know, whether we, not all of us agree about the, you know, how to deal with carbon. But we all agree on energy efficiency, so we're trying to find areas of consensus. And that's one area that we identified on the energy side that we'd like to work with.
Well, that's very encouraging that there's a Problem Solvers Group with 80 members of Congress in it. And that plays right into something that came across my computer screen today. I subscribe to Zogby and to his updates and polls and newsletters. And that came across as a flash today from Zogby that they are seeing a lot of groundswell for a third party coming out of the Republicans, not the Tea Party, a real third party.
What do you mean a third party coming out? I mean,
a real true third political party that may be formed out of the Republicans. We have 2 minutes left.
Yeah. Well, I hadn't seen what Zogby had written about. I mean, third parties, you know, historically haven't done very well, but you know, who knows? I mean, there's a lot of work going on within the Republican Party to make sure that we do what we must do to become more appealing, certainly to younger voters and others where we've had difficulties. So believe me, there's a lot in motion. I had not seen the Zogby report though, so I really can't comment on it.
And do you feel optimistic? Getting back to our theme of hope here tonight, do you feel optimistic that the Republican Party can heal itself for 2014 and 2016?
No, absolutely, absolutely. In fact, the one thing playing to the Republican advantage right now, let's face it, is the health care law. I mean, I did see some polls on that, and you know, whatever damage, and I very much opposed the government shutdown and did everything I could to get it reopened quickly. But whatever short-term damage that occurred there, and all those polling numbers, they've essentially just reversed themselves due to the shutdown, and now the Democrats are in a predicament because their numbers are in a very bad place right now in terms of their congressional seats. Anyway, so it's so both parties have some work to do on rebranding and really restoring their images. So this is a bipartisan problem now.
Well, we are going to have to wrap it up at this point, and we are very grateful to you, Congressman Dent, for a very informative and interesting program. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Pam. Thanks, Chris, for having me.
Thanks, Congressman.
All righty. Take care.
I want to officially thank all of my guests this evening, the Lieutenant Governor of Pennsylvania, Jim Cawley, Congressman Charlie Dent, representing the 15th District of Pennsylvania, and Professor Chris Borick of Muhlenberg College here with me in the studio. And I want to thank our listeners for a very engaging evening, and we are looking forward to being back with you for Lehigh Valley Discourse again. Please tune in to WDIY Community Public Radio. I'm Pamela Varconi. Good night.